Hub
and Spoke
Audio Collective.
Between September 1979 and January 1980, San Francisco Police Lieutenant George LaBrash received $6,500 in workman's comp, a figure he considered hardly enough. The City Retirement Board had declined his claim for an additional $18,400 in disability benefits that LaBrash said San Francisco owed him for the peril they'd placed him in. So, he appealed the decision to Superior Court Judge Richard P. Fagone. Lieutenant LaBrash's wasn't a typical sort of on-duty injury for SFPD. He wasn't shot or struck or involved in a car accident. And the assignment at which he'd received the injury was far less dangerous on its face than many situations his career had put him in. He wasn't pulling over motorists, breaking up drug rings, or serving warrants. Lieutenant LaBrash had been on security detail in September 1979 at the DeYoung Museum when he suffered a stroke. Not immediately obvious how one connects to the other, but LaBrash's lawyer, Michael Hebel, laid it out for Judge Fagone. To quote his court brief, LaBrash suffered a stroke after having positioned himself, as his employment required, directly in front of the Golden Mask, which for 3,300 years covered the head and shoulders of the mummified remains of the god king Tutankhamun. The stroke, LaBrash and Hebel argued, was no accidental act of God, but instead a very purposeful act of a god, a result of a curse pronounced by Osiris, god of the dead, on all who should disturb the dead. A curse, as Hebel laid out to the judge, that had already led to at least a dozen deaths since 1923. After hearing this patently ridiculous assertion, laid out in absurd historical detail, Judge Fagone had no choice but to agree to hear the case. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. For our second spooky October episode, we're telling a different kind of story. There isn't some cherry stone of reasonable belief buried inside of it, and no big policies, public or private, were built around its error. This one is pure, sensational superstition. Yet, just like for Judge Richard P. Fagone, you can't look at the litany of anecdotes and coincidences and not conclude there's something worth investigating here. So, let's do it. Today's episode, The Curse. As we learned in the last episode, Europe's relationship with mummies from the end of the 12th century on into the beginning of the 17th was mostly medicinal. The funky translation error that gave us the very word mummy led scholars and physicians throughout the medieval period to conclude that the bodies of preserved Egyptian corpses were a powerful panacea. I think it's fair to say that breaking off bits of finger or ear, grinding it into a paste, mixing it with honey, and eating it was a more profound sort of desecration than anything the archaeologists and tomb raiders of modernity ever managed. Yet, nobody during this long anthropophagical practice seems to have been much bothered by the threat of the dead or their gods coming back to punish them. But there's a seemingly reasonable explanation for why folks into the 1600s didn't fear Egyptian curses. They couldn't read them. Herapolo was, in theory, among the last priests of the Egyptian religion, living near Alexandria in the 5th century. If the Suda, a 10th century Byzantine encyclopedia theoretically written by an equally dubious figure, Sudas, is to be believed, Herapolo waged a failed revolt against the Christian church, which led to the destruction of his temple and his own forced conversion. Whether Herapolo really existed or not, he was understood to be the authority on Egyptian religion, and the Greek book ascribed to him, Hieroglyphica, the single best work for understanding the ancient Egyptian language. Hieroglyphica was lost and then rediscovered in 1419 when it was brought to Lorenz and quickly translated into print. For anyone interested in hieroglyphics before the 1800s, Hieroglyphica was the source to go to decipher the meanings of the many systematized pictorial figures that lined the tombs and artifacts of ancient Egypt. And that was unfortunate, because the explanations and definitions offered in Hieroglyphica were pretty friggin' off base. According to Hierapolo, or whomever, hieroglyphs were essentially ideograms, literal depictions of their meanings. A hieroglyph of a bird simply denoted that bird. They didn't represent any sort of specific language, sounds, or figurative concepts. Consequently, most people believed that the long strings of Egyptian writings that pocked the walls of tombs and temples were untranslatable and maybe just plain meaningless beyond the most superficial interpretations of owl hand cross, cross bull snake. In the early 1800s, the French became more fascinated with this early system of Egyptian writing. No, that word won't work, because even then it wasn't agreed that hieroglyphs were writing, although more and more people were beginning to suspect as much. It really took Jean-François Champollion to break the code. He made a very good informed guess that the Coptic language was descended from the ancient Egyptian one and began seriously trying to relate the two around 1806. Through the second decade of the 19th century, Champollion focused on deciphering the famous Rosetta Stone, which had been discovered in 1799. In case you've forgotten what exactly made the Rosetta Stone so special, as I have, let's quickly refresh. Chiseled in 196 BC in Memphis, Egypt, the Rosetta Stone contains a decree from Ptolemy V. The text is difficult, but provides a written account of the benefaction of the king towards its neighbors and church. The critically important thing about the Rosetta Stone was that it wrote out this decree three times, at the bottom in Greek, but above that in ancient Egyptian, including, at the top, hieroglyphics. Champollion, along with many others, recognized the potential to use the stone to translate the known ancient Greek writing into the unknown ancient Egyptian ones. Champollion's rival, the Englishman Thomas Young, made a good deal of progress identifying some phonemes, but couldn't shake the impression from Hieroglyphica that some portion of the text must be meaningless filler. Champollion, on the other hand, took a systematic approach, finding the value of 12 signs by identifying famous names on the stone, including Ptolemy and Cleopatra. By the end of September 1822, Champollion's system was correctly translating bit after bit of the stone. Eventually, he deciphered the entirety of the text and demystified, literally, Egyptian hieroglyphics. Just 5 years later, the first account of a mummy's curse was written. But that's totally coincidental, because there are no writings in Egyptian hieroglyphics of a mummy's curse. Well, no, okay, that's a bit reductive. There are a few curses written on Egyptian tombs, but they're mostly found written for minor aristocrats and usually address contemporary people, priests and kings, who they warn to honor them appropriately. There are only a handful of times where such warnings say anything about desecrators or robbers. The beginning of the mummy's curse doesn't stem from any of these very rare Egyptian execration texts, but instead from English sci-fi author Jane Webb, who anonymously released a novel in 1827 entitled The Mummy, A Tale of the 22nd Century. The Mummy, there's an exclamation point there that demands to be voiced, was written when Webb was just 17 and owes several dozen major debts to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is fast on its way to becoming the most referenced book in this show's whole life. The titular mummy, Cheops, is revitalized not by ancient magic, but by galvanic resurrection. And while plenty of romantic tragedy befalls the people of 2126 London, none of it is due to magic. In the 1860s, three separate stories crop up that more explicitly feature a mummy taking revenge upon its discoverers, but none of these were very widely read. The last of the three, 1869's Lost in a Pyramid or The Mummy's Curse, was even written by Little Women author Louisa May Alcott, but that didn't protect it from being completely forgotten until the 1990s. Between a handful of novels and an even smaller handful of actual hieroglyphics, there might have been a nascent sense of a mummy's curse out there in the wild from the late 19th century on. But the thing that crystallized the idea and brought it to popular consciousness was, without a doubt, a single discovery made in 1922, the unearthing of King Tutankhamun's tomb. Tutankhamun was only 8 years old when he ascended to Pharaoh, and he only lived to be 17 or 18. His reign was short, but not uneventful. Before Tutankhamun, the capital of Egypt had been moved to Akhetaten, and the state religion had been recentered around the singular sun god, Aten. Tutankhamun returned the capital to Thebes and returned the Egyptian religion to its old polytheistic pantheon. And his death was important, too. Lacking an heir, the end of Tutankhamun was the end of his line and the end of a political age. Still, even with all that, he was only a minor figure to those studying ancient history, until 1922. By the 20th century, the ruins of ancient Egypt had been, well, yeah, ruined. Several millennia worth of invaders, pilgrims, marauders, and wanderers of every conceivable ethnic and religious stripe had plodded and stomped over the old cities and tombs, centuries of grave robbers seeking riches or even medicinal mummy parts, and Napoleon's troops in particular had ransacked, bombarded, and pilfered every last corner they could get their hands on back in the early 1800s. The same French obsession that led to Champollion deciphering the hieroglyphics also led to the carting of dozens of mummies into Europe for the sole purpose of publicly unwrapping them for sheer entertainment value, which, by the way, probably inspired Jane Webb. But King Tutankhamun's tomb was hidden away beneath a workers' settlement built 150 or so years after it was completed. So, when British Egyptologist Howard Carter found a subterranean stairway leading to a door in 1922, it was cause for an almost unprecedented level of excitement. Inside, Carter found the most complete tomb ever discovered, stuffed with golden artifacts, invaluable antiquities, several mummified bodies, and an unthinkable curse. When Michael Hebel argued before the Superior Court in 1979 that George Labrash's stroke was just the latest in a long string of injuries and deaths attributable to the pharaoh's curse, what 12 previous victims did he describe? By 1935, a full 21 had been named in the press, after all. The first victim came the very day the seal was broken. James Henry Breasted, founder of the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, was with Carter to help decipher hieroglyphs when the tomb was found. That evening, when Breasted returned to his camp, he heard a strange, inhuman scream and found that his pet canary had been devoured by a cobra, which still sat lurking in its cage. On March 25th, 1923, a year after the tomb was discovered, and just a month after King Tut's burial chamber was opened, the financier of the expedition, George Edward Stanhope Molyneux Herbert, 5th Earl of Carnarvon, was bitten by a mosquito. Sailing south to Aswan, he managed to cut open the bite while shaving. Carnarvon was 57 years old, weak, and suffered from recurrent bouts of pneumonia. Within days, the wound became infected, his pneumonia spiked, and on April 5th, he died of blood poisoning. But many people, including especially the press, knew it couldn't be as innocuous as that. Word was that upon his final breath, the electricity went out in Cairo, and his dog back in England howled and collapsed dead. Reporters and writers conjectured all sorts of outlandish explanations for Carnarvon's end. Maybe the tomb had been booby-trapped, Indiana Jones style, or maybe there were poisonous bats within the chamber, the guano of which poisoned him. Perhaps the mosquito was to blame, after all, but only because it had already drunk from the embalming fluid-filled veins of the boy king before it alighted upon the earl. All of these explanations fell apart under scrutiny. The builders of the tomb didn't have the means to make a trap durable enough to last 3,000 years, but they were able to seal the site up so that bats couldn't have lived inside. And the mosquito, the bit Carnarvon, didn't come from the Valley of the Gods in Egypt. It was too dry there to accommodate them. In that case, the cause of the Earl's freak death was plain to see. The curse. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, of Sherlock Holmes fame, said as much, remarking that the priests of Egypt must have sent an elemental to protect the grave from desecrators. Doyle explained that already one such elemental was known in England, attached to a mummy housed at the British Museum. This was understood because, to quote Doyle, everyone who came into contact with it came to grief. This was the mummy of a queen, and even one of my dear friends, a journalist, who investigated the misfortunes that befell those who handled the mummy, was himself stricken with typhoid fever and died. Rumors began to leak out that Howard Carter had removed and destroyed a plaque at the tomb's entrance, which read, Death comes on swift wings to he who disturbs the tomb of the pharaoh. To the New York Times, Carter said, "It is rather too much to ask me to believe that some spook is keeping watch and ward over the dead pharaoh, ready to wreak vengeance on anyone who goes too near." But this was taken as just another conspiratorial denial, meant to throw the public off from the truth. And it wasn't working. When Tutankhamun was unwrapped in 1925, a hole was discovered upon his cheek, right where the mosquito had bitten Lord Carnarvon. By that time, the curse had already claimed 5 more victims. George Gould, an American railroad magnate, visited the tomb in early May of 1923 and was dead from pneumonia by the middle of the month. In January of 1923, the Egyptian aristocrat Ali Kamal Fahmy Bey had married French socialite Marguerite Marie Albert. A short while after, he had himself photographed within the infamous tomb. Then, on July 1st, 1923, Marguerite shot him in the back 3 times during an argument at London Savoy Hotel. Just months after the shooting, Colonel Aubrey Hebert, Lord Carnarvon's half-brother, succumbed himself to blood poisoning. Sir Archibald Douglas Reed, who distinguished himself as one of England's first and greatest radiologists, was given the opportunity to X-ray Tutankhamun's mummy. Soon after, he fell ill, and on January 15th, 1924, he was taken by a mysterious illness. On November 19th, 1924, the British Governor General of Anglo-Egyptian Sudan was assassinated by a group of Egyptian students who shot a burst of pistol fire into his stopped car. Reportedly, he'd been at the tomb too. And, most chillingly, there was Hugh Evelyn White, a British archaeologist who hung himself in 1924, leaving a suicide note written in his own blood, which read, "I have succumbed to a curse which forces me to disappear." If Carter were trying to suppress knowledge of the curse, he was failing magnificently. The press was all over the story, and public hysteria spread thick over the world. Benito Mussolini himself, having previously accepted a mummy as a diplomatic gift, had it removed from his palace. And along with the panic over the curse itself kept up a terrifying pace. On April 6th, 1928, one of Carter's partners, A.C. Mace, died, curiously, from arsenic poisoning. A year and change after that, Mervyn Herbert, Lord Carnarvon's other half-brother, and apparently a very good cricket player, died of malarial pneumonia at the British Embassy in Rome. Richard Bethell, Howard Carter's personal secretary, died in November of 1929. He was found in bed at Mayfair's Bath Club, the victim of an apparent smothering, according to historian Mark Benyon. A year before his death, Bethell's house, which held several of Tutankhamun's antiquities, mysteriously caught fire several times, according to the Nottingham Evening Post. 3 months later, Richard's father, the 3rd Baron of Westbury, threw himself from the 7th floor window of his London flat, leaving behind a shiver-inducing note which began, "I really cannot stand any more horrors." If you're not yet convinced, let me assure you, there are more. Plenty more. As many freak accidents, mysterious illnesses, and gruesome murders to convince even the most skeptical of materialists that some foul imprecation or hex was surely set to grim work after the opening of the tomb. So allow yourself to believe, if just for a moment. Believe that there is some sort of force out there ready to punish impiety where mortal justice fails. That there is something willing and able to protect against the most profane of trespasses. And if you can't manage that, then at least take a second to picture yourself at the entrance of that tomb. Imagine picking your foot up and pushing it out across the venerable threshold. See yourself crossing into the stale darkness of 3,000 years now past, amid the mysteries of the oldest, deepest death. Imagine setting eyes upon the great golden sarcophagus of the Boy King, glinting by dullest torchlight, unseen for millennia. Put yourself there and feel the churn of your knotted stomach, the tensity of your tremulous skin, the pounding of your nervous heart. That is the feeling. That is what it means to believe in the curse. And now that you do, let's talk about why it's bullshit. This episode of The Constant is brought to you by BetterHelp. If there's something getting in the way of your happiness or ambitions, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. With BetterHelp, you can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment on your own time and at your own pace via secure video, phone, chat, or text sessions with your own therapist. BetterHelp has licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, LGBT matters, trauma, relationships, anxiety, sleeplessness, and more. And anything you share with them is confidential. And if at any time you're not satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one. BetterHelp's secure, convenient, professional counseling is available worldwide and as soon as 24 hours after signing up. Best of all, it's affordable, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. And Constant listeners get 10% off their first month with discount code THECONSTANT. That's one word, THECONSTANT. So, why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/theconstant. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/theconstant. Discount code, one word, THECONSTANT. First of all, there was no tablet at the entrance or anywhere else, no execration stone, no curse written anywhere in, on, or around the tomb. The media just plain made it up. Carter's quest had taken close to 5 years and an untold fortune to complete. In an effort to recoup some of the expenses, Carnarvon signed a deal giving the Times of London exclusive access to reporting. The news of King Tutankhamun's tomb was the biggest thing in years, but nobody but the Times was getting any access. That effectively meant that every other news agency in the world was left to either admit they didn't have the story or else just print a bunch of gossip and skinder. Naturally, they chose the latter. The worst offender was Arthur Weigel of the Daily Mail, who was particularly vexed by his rival at the Times nabbing the story. Weigel wasn't totally comfortable flinging pure flim-flam, but without any real news to tell, he quickly inured himself to writing innuendo and gossip, authoring stories about the ill-fated canary, which probably didn't even exist, and claiming that he had predicted Lord Carnarvon's death after watching him casually clod about the dig site. In his 1923 book, Tutankhamun and Other Essays, Weigel claims he, quote, turned to the man next to me and said, if he goes down there in that spirit, I give him 6 weeks to live. It was Weigel who, in all likelihood, invented the part about the Earl's dog dying, and a different reporter who broke the story that Carnarvon's death had come in tandem with a Cairo blackout, without noting that Cairo was subject to blackouts almost daily. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, on the other hand, is this the first time we've talked about Arthur Conan Doyle? Well, it won't be the last. The delicious irony of Doyle's life is that while he is famous for having created the most observant, credible, and scrupulous detective in literary history, he, himself, was regularly hornswoggled by even the most incompetent of supernatural fraudsters. Responding to his claim about the cursed mummy in the British Museum, an official released a statement to the Hull Daily Mail, which read, in part, none of the officials of the Egyptian Department of the British Museum is aware of the existence of any such mummy. Doyle's retort to this was to confidently state that he knew a thing or two about ancient Egypt, that the museum did not, owing to the frequent conversations he held with a 3,000-year-old Arabian spirit that his medium wife put him in touch with. That bizarre flex is important to note, because while the press and popular authors like Doyle and Marie Corelli did a lot of heavy lifting to hold up the mummy's curse story, the sentiments of the time did good work all on their own. The 1920s were the age of spiritualism and theosophy. People from every walk of life, in England, in France, in America, were obsessed by stories of ghosts, spirits, mediums, and psychics. The idea that the afterlife was sitting just a micron away from the world of the flesh, regularly making contact was immensely popular. With that baseline, it was practically a given that you couldn't go stomping into the crypt of a mysterious 3,000-year dead boy king preserved through ritual science and long-lost religion without tracking out a bit of ectoplasm on your shoe. But what about all those deaths? Yeah, well, what about them? The canary is Bunko, pure and simple. Let's just wipe that one off right away. Depending on the telling, it belonged either to Breasted, Carnarvon, or even Carter himself, and that's pretty fishy. And Weigel fashioned the story of it being eaten by a cobra only after he became aware of the cobra on the pharaoh's headpiece. Prince Ali Kamel Fami Bey was, according to his spouse-cum-killer's trial, a ruthless, abusive monster who Marguerite shot to be rid of him. She was acquitted, and even though that probably had as much to do with her defense stoking some big league racism against the dead Egyptian, it's at least clear that no magic had to be called upon to convince his wife to widow herself. Plus, I can't actually find any evidence that he ever visited the tomb in the first place, outside of some yellow journalism and conspiracy mongering. Sir Archibald Douglas Reed, who x-rayed Tutankhamun before dying of a mysterious illness? Anybody want to take a stab at what kind of mystery illness might befall an early 20th century radiologist? That's right. Douglas Reed, like literally dozens of other early x-ray experimenters, died of radiation poisoning. A.C. Mace's strange arsenic poisoning wasn't really so strange at all. Mace had been in failing health for years, even had to leave the expedition early to return home to try to convalesce. He died surrounded by his family after a long illness, not from the disease itself, but from the treatment, arsenic salts, a now discredited medical salve. Lord Carnarvon himself was sickly and unlucky, but let's address his two half-brothers. Mervyn Herbert died of malaria after a trip from Albania to Rome, unfortunately common in those days. Colonel Aubrey Herbert died from blood poisoning, which sounds ominous, but not really. Aubrey suffered from a lifelong degenerative eye condition. Before he died, he had gone completely blind and was advised by some crackpot physician to have all of his teeth removed in order to restore his sight. Why that would have worked, I can't say, but it didn't, and Aubrey acquired a severe and terrible infection from the procedure that spread and became septic. As for the other two related victims, Howard Carter's secretary Richard Bethel and his father, well, that's a particularly awful and tragic story. Bethel himself was not smothered in his sleep, unless you count emphysema as a hooded night murderer. Bethel had come to Mayfair's bath club for treatment, but as we know from a past episode, balneotherapy doesn't work, and pretty much nothing can save you from emphysema. The historian, and I'm air-quoting that to the point of near injury, who presented Bethel's death as mysterious is, judging by his work on this story alone, a charlatan, peddling in a conspiracy theory so ridiculous that it barely warrants mention, except to say that it involves a wide-ranging and improbable plot by occultist Aleister Crowley, who really murdered everybody on behalf of King Tut. It is true that Bethel's house had caught fire several times previous to his death, but that mystery was solved when it was discovered that one of his footmen was a serial arsonist. As for Bethel's father, the Lord Westbury, he also had suffered from poor yet still declining health, which was in no way helped by the premature death of his son. His suicide note did, in fact, begin, "I really cannot stand any more horrors." But it continued, "I hardly see what good I am going to do here. So I'm going to make my exit. Goodbye. And if you are right, all will be well." I don't have any such good explanation for the pneumonia death of railroad owner George Gould or the suicide of archaeologist Hugh Evelyn White, except to say that it is a terrible fact of life that people die and that people kill themselves. And that, more than any particular refutation, is what puts down the idea of the mummy's curse. Since 1930, a number of people, including magician and professional skeptic James Randi, have attempted to work out just how effective the supposed curse was. Randi notes that if these incidents do have King Tut at their heart, his priorities sure are pretty screwed. He apparently found it necessary to kill off princes who might not even have visited him, and the half-brothers of one of the tomb's raiders. Yet, Howard Carter, the man who discovered the site, who first entered it, who spent the most time there, and was the person most responsible for the mummy's removal, he was given the okay. While the curse took Carnarvon's half-brothers, who had nothing to do with the dig, it spared his daughter, who was actually there in Egypt working on the excavation. She lived until 1980. Of the dozens of people working in the Valley of the Gods, a maximum of 8 of them died in the first 15 years following the tomb's discovery. According to Randy's math, the average age of death for those who worked at Tut's tomb was 73, which was actually 2 years older than the average life expectancy of the time. In 2002, Mark Nelson of Monash University in Melbourne completed a study of 44 Westerners in Egypt during 1922. A little over half of those he studied had been exposed to the curse, having been at the breaking of the seal, the opening of the sarcophagus, or the unwrapping of the mummy. The others had no relationship with the excavation or subsequent scholarship. He found no statistically significant difference in their lifespans or health outcomes. I don't usually tell stories on this show about superstitions or urban legends because they seem like a lower level of error than what I'm interested in. The answer to why people believe in them tends to be a simple, because they're the kinds of stories we're primed to be scared by. And the answer to why they aren't true is the even simpler, because they're not. But if we allow ourselves to look at the story of the Pharaoh's curse granularly, case by case, as Judge Richard P. Fagone did, we can find our way into a deeper and more unsettling sort of fallacy. Because when you zoom in close and look around hard at the people surrounding this particular urban legend, it looks, well, if not convincing, at least unsettling. There are too many murders, too many suicides, too many arsons, and finally, too many mysteries. The closer you look, the more abnormal it all seems. And every statistical or actuarial assurance in the world won't put those primal suspicions to bed. We can find a similar phenomenon in any popular conspiracy theory we choose to stare at. In 1967, Josiah Tink Thompson authored 6 Seconds in Dallas, a meticulous, fine-toothed examination of the Kennedy assassination, down practically to the molecule. In the Zapruder film, a mysterious figure can be seen holding a large black umbrella on that totally rainless November day in Dallas. To many people since that day, the Umbrella Man has represented an unfathomable incongruity, a surefire sign that something larger than a single shooter in a book depository was at play. But eventually, it was confirmed that said man was, in actuality, a rather obtuse protester who expected his umbrella to be seen as a symbolic protest of JFK's father's support for Neville Chamberlain. John Updike, in considering the almost unthinkably capricious meaninglessness of this seemingly important event, wrote the following. We wonder whether a genuine mystery is being concealed here, or whether any similar scrutiny of a minute section of time and space would yield similar strangenesses. Gaps, inconsistencies, warps, and bubbles in the surface of circumstance. Perhaps, as with the elements of matter, investigation passes a threshold of common sense and enters a subatomic realm where laws are mocked, where persons have the lifespan of beta particles and the transparency of neutrinos, and where a rough kind of averaging out must substitute for absolute truth. The truth about those seconds in Dallas is especially elusive. The search for it seems to demonstrate how perilously empiricism verges on magic. I think that's right. I think the true magic and the true curse threatens us not through ancient sigils or phantasmal revenants, but through the common and common sense belief that if we just observe a thing straight on by measure of the facts, we will be brought inextricably towards the truth. It is a sentiment that is as indispensable as it is problematic. And I find it to be the most terrifying curse I can possibly bestow upon you for this spooky October. That the only means we have to determine what to believe can cause us to believe anything. In the end, Judge Richard P. Fagone denied LaBrash's claim. Music for today's episode by Lee Rose Vare, Blue Dot Sessions, Kevin MacLeod, and Anime is Trash. If you're enjoying the show, please go rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and even better, introduce us to a friend. If you're really enjoying the show, be sure to visit patreon.com/theconstant to become a sponsor. We're now just $50 short of our first long-term goal. When we hit it, I'll begin working on a second podcast, a spin-off of The Constant, not about the things we didn't know in the past, but about the things we continue to not know today. If that sounds like something you want to hear, you can help us get there right now. Thank you for listening. We'll be back together in 2 weeks. Until then, from Chicago, Illinois, home to the Field Museum, where you can walk a reconstruction of a mummy's tomb, if you dare. This has been The Constant. On March 25th, 1923, a year after the tomb was discovered, and just a month after King Tut's burial chamber was opened, the financier of the expedition, George Edward Stanhope Molyneux Herbert, the 5th Earl of Carnarvon. Carnarvon. Boy, I'm going to have to say it so many times. Carnarvon. It's a lot of weird little consonant clusters, right, kind of abutting one another. Carnarvon. Yeah. A year and change after that, Mervyn Herbert, Lord Carveron's... God damn it. Radio.